I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Our conversation today, the life of Martin Luther King. As the 40th anniversary of his death approaches, has his legacy been distorted by both blacks and whites? But first, news from Zimbabwe. The election results trickling in show President Robert Mugabe's 28-year grasp on power slipping. His party has lost control of parliament, and the main opposition party of Morgan Tsvangirai is claiming outright victory in Saturday's disputed presidential election. The Mugabe government has warned that any premature victory claim would be considered a coup attempt. The European Union wants Mugabe to step down, and a White House spokesman once again effectively endorsed Tsvangirai today. Scott Baldoff is Southern Africa correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He's in Johannesburg. And Scott, to the parliamentary results first, they would seem to bolster the presidential results. Is that how they're being seen?
Well, most people who would have voted for a parliamentarian sides with the opposition is likely to vote presidential candidate of the same party. That's the reasoning of Morgan Tsvangirai's party. At this point, though, we are not seeing the official results coming out from the official electoral commission, and this is raising some concerns. Are the books being cooked? Are the votes being manipulated? And this is something that is being raised both by the U.S. and U.K. government, but also by the opposition party.
By the opposition party, as you said. Well, but it would seem as if U.S. officials seem to be saying that they believe that Tsvangirai is the winner.
And that's what Tsvangirai thinks himself. He today held a press conference and declared himself the winner, giving himself 50.3% as opposed to 43% of Robert Mugabe. Now, again, these rallies, they're drawn up by polling agents at each of the polling stations where the MDC had their people. They believe that their numbers are correct because those are the actual official numbers from the different polling stations.
So it shows Tsvangirai just slightly ahead. But will there be a runoff, as the state newspaper, The Herald, has been predicting?
Well, it's such a razor-thin majority. It's very likely that if there is any margin of error, it's likely to go down as much as it is to go up. So we could see a runoff. Now, here is the real question. When this goes to a runoff, you would expect the state and Mugabe to have an advantage there. But Mugabe's party is so split now, and the sentiment is so strong against Mugabe and the party because of the economic collapse that people are experiencing. It's very unlikely that election is going to go his way. Question is, what will Mugabe do? Will he deploy the army to intimidate people? Have war veterans and youth militia who have for him in the past intimidate people, keep them from voting? These are all possibilities.
And we know that Tsvangirai must have that very much in mind. He and 49 of his supporters were beaten and sent to the hospital last year. Well, you've been reporting that there's been sort of these backroom negotiations underway. We've heard other analysts say that the hope is that they will provide President Mugabe with a soft landing, a way to exit with some grace.
Well, I think at this point, it may be as much greed as grace. The army chiefs who met with Tsvangirai's people, from what we understand, from what our sources are telling us, were largely asking for immunity from past corruption charges that may come up under a new government, and also to guarantee that they get their seats, continue to have the power that they have currently. These are obviously conditions that the MDC is unlikely to accept, and certainly they would be unlikely to accept them in regards to Robert Mugabe. Many people within the MDC are saying, let's just go for it. We know we have the numbers.
Scott, do you think we're going to know anything soon? How long do you think this will drag out?
Look, I mean, I think, honestly, I do think we're close to an end game. This is what a lot of the people are telling us, that Mugabe is running out of options. He doesn't particularly relish the idea of going before The Hague, so this is the reason why they're dragging things out as much as they can to get some sort of guarantees. But he doesn't have much control anymore over his own party. So my guess is that this could go to the end of the week.
That's Scott Baldoff, Southern Africa correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, speaking to us on a kind of a shaky line from Johannesburg, South Africa. But Scott, we so appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Robin.
This Friday marks the 40th anniversary of the assassination of the Reverend Martin Luther King, Jr.
This is an NBC News Hotline special report. Here is Don Hickman in Memphis.
Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. was shot outside a Memphis motel this afternoon. His condition is not known at this time.
News of King's death sparked riots in many cities. President Johnson went on national TV to appeal for calm.
I ask every citizen to reject the blind violence that has struck Dr. King.
The speech that King delivered in Memphis the night before he was shot seemed to be a premonition. Like anybody, he said, I'd like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But today, King has been dead longer than he lived. And our next guest says his death has caused us to lose track of his life. Michael Eric Dyson is professor of sociology at Georgetown University, author of April 4th, 1968, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Death and How It Changed America. Professor Dyson joins us from the studios of WFYI in Indianapolis. Professor, welcome.
Thank you so much, Ms. Young, for having me.
Well, some provocative thoughts you've got here. Let me see if I can pull together a few. First of all, you say that whites in America have absolved themselves of blame for producing the murderous passions that finally killed King, and instead they've given King some lesser victories, including a national holiday. But then you write, if many whites have undercut King by praising him to death, blacks have hollowed his individuality through worship. Whites want King clawless, blacks want him flawless.
Yes, ma'am.
Take those one at a time. What do you mean?
The kind of denial of complicity in the very act of murdering Martin Luther King Jr. is critical to the nation saying we can reward him with a holiday by denying our complicity collectively, no individual complicity, but collective complicity, because a lot of people who were white thought it was a good idea to murder Martin Luther King Jr.
You're right. If one man held a gun, millions more propped him up and made it seem good. And you say that what we're forgetting is just how much heat and hate the thought of King could whip up. Tell us more about that, because the caricature of Martin Luther King is of the good, peaceful, accepted black activist, whereas Malcolm X might have been considered by many whites the violent, bad black activist. What's wrong with that memory of Martin Luther King?
Well, it's just not accurate. Think about Jeremiah Wright and what he's getting now. Intensify that about 1,000 times, and you might imagine what Martin Luther King Jr. Received. He wasn't on the top 10 most admired Americans list for a decade. You know, he had been on there. He fell off in 67. No American publisher wanted to publish a book by him. Universities didn't extend lecture invitations to him. He was at the nadir, the low point of his popularity with white America. The second in command of the FBI called him the most dangerous Negro leader in America. I mean, Martin Luther King Jr. was widely reviled. Now, it is true, when Martin Luther King Jr. was joined by Malcolm X and Stokely Carmichael and Floyd McKissick and others who were less likely to restrain black people in their inclinations for violent self-defense, Martin Luther King Jr. looked better. But the reality is he was seen for so much of his career as a pariah. He started that way. Then he ascended to the heights of American acceptance. He won the Nobel Prize, Time Magazine Man of the Year. He gave the I Have a Dream speech. And he was seen as a great Negro leader. But when he began to speak out against the war in Vietnam, he was denigrated. I can't help but think as Lyndon Baines Johnson went on television to pray for peace in the aftermath of Dr. King's death, I can't help but remembering he called him a GDN preacher, the N-word, when Dr. King spoke out against the war in Vietnam.
In fact, we have him speaking against the war. This is a much less remembered speech than the ones we tend to hear this time of year, the I Have Been to a Mountaintop speech. This is April 4th, 1967, a year to the day before he died, speaking really for the first time against the Vietnam War. Let's listen.
As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. I have tried to offer them my deepest compassion while maintaining my conviction that social change comes most meaningfully through nonviolent action. But they ask, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? They ask if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problems, to bring about the changes it wanted. Their questions hit home, and I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government.
Michael Eric Dyson, it's funny, that does sound a little bit like the chicken coming home to roost speech that we just heard from Jeremiah Wright in the past few weeks. That's Martin Luther King, though, speaking at Riverside Church in New York City, 1967. What was happening as he protested the war, poverty, racism that he saw among whites? What was happening to his reputation?
Well, it was taking a beating and a battering. He was even more harsh in his denunciation of that war among black audiences. And then when we talk about, you know, the chickens coming home to roost of Malcolm X that Jeremiah Wright cited, let's not forget that Martin Luther King Jr., when he spoke to black audiences, was equally as honest. He said, for instance, that I don't know about you, but I'm tired of being on the reservation, but on the reservation too long. I don't want them to do to us what they did to the Japanese. He said America was founded on genocide. He was direct and angry. Even John F. Kennedy said having Martin Luther King Jr. come to the White House was like having Karl Marx there. Bobby Kennedy okayed the wiretaps on Martin Luther King Jr. So even ostensible allies among liberals worked against Dr. King's ultimate best interest. But Americans began to turn against him. They said he was creating and causing violence by being much more aggressive in his nonviolence with the Poor People's Campaign in Washington, D.C. The newspapers began to wonder out loud if he was not contributing to the violence that he so brilliantly declared himself to be against. So Martin Luther King Jr. was facing a sea change of opposition to his beliefs.
Well, if, as you say, whites in America have manufactured this sort of safe image of Martin Luther King since his death, what have blacks done?
Martin Luther King Jr. has been made clawless by white America, a toothless tiger, and black people have turned him into this, iridescent saint and this flawless human being who didn't have flaws and failures. And black people have demanded in return for their adoration of this figure and in compensation for elements of white America denigrating Dr. King, they have repaid him with a kind of sainthood that does a great disservice to their own cause. If you think of Martin Luther King Jr. as a perfect figure, then you can't encourage younger people to become like him or to have the same aspirations because, after all, I can never be like him. And then secondly, you use Dr. King's alleged flawlessness to beat up on young people who are themselves flawed, and we make them aware of their flaws, and we don't even allow them the privilege of deriving mental support from an identification with a figure who was flawed like them. So it cuts in both ways, but both negatively.
Well, and what does that do to young blacks in particular? We want to hear more about that from Michael Eric Dyson. His new book, April 4th, 1968, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Death and How It Changed America. And, of course, Friday, the 40th anniversary of King's assassination. We'll have that. And later today, Running for the Gold When You Can Hardly Breathe. We'll speak with an Olympic marathoner, Dina Castor, heading to Beijing. Back in 1 minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're back with more from Michael Eric Dyson, author of the new book, April 4th, 1968, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Death and How It Changed America, this Friday being the 40th anniversary of King's assassination. Professor, you write that King, during his life, was seen by racist whites as a threat, but in death, whites have manufactured a sort of safer image for him. While blacks have turned King into a saint without flaws, and you point out this was a man who did have flaws. He had affairs, he strayed from his marriage, and he had illness. He suffered severe depression.
Yeah, he had terrible depression and guilt. The guilt that he endured certainly came from his failure to live up to his own ideals, but the depression he had mostly resulted from the relentless pursuit by the government and by white racists of Martin Luther King Jr. The fact is that the FBI under J. Edgar Hoover did not protect Dr. King, and not only that, they left him vulnerable. So Martin Luther King Jr. was being hounded and harassed from within the government, outside of the government, by citizens across the nation, by white racist groups, by people who were determined to wipe him off of the face of the earth. And so, naturally enough, he was depressed. 2 and 3 days, he would sometimes get into the bed and couldn't get out. Vicious hiccups that would assault him, besiege him, overtake him. And then when he got up to speak, flawless. Then he sat back down, more hiccups. He took pills from doctors that ceased to work, so he couldn't sleep. This man, as Andrew Young, his aide, said, had a war on sleep. And yet, despite all of that, he kept on speaking out and kept on speaking against the war in Vietnam, against the premises of white supremacy, social injustice, economic inequality. And by the way, equally a part of that expression was a criticism of black bourgeois culture and the failure of black people to stand up for the interests of vulnerable and poor blacks. So Martin Luther King Jr.'s prophetic articulation cut both ways.
The other problem with this sort of cleaned up image of Dr. Martin Luther King as sort of a serene being is that, you know, young people in particular don't get to learn that there are tortured souls who can also achieve some greatness.
My God. I mean, they look at Kurt Cobain and Tupac Shakur, but they could add Martin Luther King Jr., tortured by his failures, grieved by his guilt, enormously motivated by the embarrassment of not being able to live up to the best ideals that he nurtured in his bosom on the one hand, and then resentful that he was being exposed for it on the other. And yet in the midst of that, wanting to work on behalf of a nation to make sure it could get right for all of the faults and flaws that it possessed, and being willing to die for it, and yet the nation wanted to kill him because he wanted to make it better and to hew more closely to the ideas upon which it was founded. That is the Martin Luther King Jr. that we have had a difficult time trying to grasp hold of and to remember. That's why celebrating his death is equally as important as celebrating his life. His life is Christmas. April 4, 1968 is Easter. This is crucifixion. This is then potentially resurrection and all of the problems that are attendant upon that.
You were 10 years old when Martin Luther King died. What do
nine
you?
9 years. As
nine, even less. Mm-hmm. Did you have an image of him?
Just what I saw on the television that night. When you played at the beginning of the program the announcement of Dr. King having been shot, I remember that on the local television. I was sitting in front of the TV watching it with my father, who sat behind me, and when they announced that Dr. King had been shot, I had never heard his name, never knew who he was. He went, as if somebody had hit him in the gut. And it gathered into its phrase, the pathos. It brimmed with the steely and determination to be stoic in the face of hurt and pain. But then the pathos was there. And my father gave, voice to that in that moment. And I became immediately attracted to this figure. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory. And then he turns, walks back into the waiting arms of Ralph Abernathy and the kudos and the outstretched arms of Jesse Jackson, having delivered his final words, his benediction, his swan song, unbeknownst to him. And yet, as you said, it brimmed with premonition, this speech, as most of his speeches at the end did, because how could one not help but be premonitional about a future death that was nearly guaranteed because of the path you pursued? A path, by the way, to make the nation better, to bring it into the circumference of love. That Martin Luther King Jr. is the Martin Luther King Jr. that we have trouble grappling with.
Michael Eric Dyson, one last brief question. What do you think Martin Luther King, this is a terrible thing to do, put you in someone else's mind, but you have spent time there, tried to be there. What do you think Martin Luther King would think of Barack Obama's campaign for president?
Well, I think on the one hand, he would be quite pleased by the fact that a young black man, a political prodigy and a phenom, has emerged to speak the destiny of America in the language it finds palatable. But as Mr. Obama himself said when asked on a CNN debate, tell us why Dr. King would support your candidacy, Mr. Obama said he wouldn't. He wouldn't support anybody's candidacy. What he would do was ask America to hold those leaders accountable. After all, Martin Luther King Jr. stood against Lyndon Baines Johnson, who had delivered to black people the Civil Rights Bill, and yet because of his opposition to the war in Vietnam, King stood up and was brave. That kind of courage is rare, rarer still in a figure celebrated in America as an icon, and yet he was willing to surrender that iconic status for the purposes of elevating his people.
Do you think Barack Obama is having to walk that same fine line in a way that Martin Luther King did, and that ultimately has to face that same desire on the part of the American people to have their black public figures clawless and flawless?
Yes, he is definitely walking that tightrope of being able to tell the truth on the one hand about the history and acrimony of race, and at the other hand, to envision a new possibility and a new day.
Well, and I was just thinking, though, that there are some who might say, look, you know what, Hillary Clinton is being asked to be the same thing, clawless and flawless.
Oh, Hillary Clinton is, in terms of gender, is no question. Yeah, I mean, Hillary Clinton is, and even more so, because gender hasn't found the right register in this country, or at least as volatile an expression of it visibly, and to grapple with that as has race. So in many ways, she's walking an equally tough tightrope in regard to gender.
Yeah. Michael Eric Dyson, his new book is April 4th, 1968, Martin Luther King's Death and How It Changed America. Professor Dyson is a professor of sociology at Georgetown University and the author of 16 other books. Professor, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Ms. Young, thank you so much for this opportunity.
Well, still to come today, did you volunteer to test that new Google TV site? You got punked by the internet. Internet hoaxes. After the news, here and now. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has suggested that President Bush boycott the opening ceremonies of the Olympic Games. Others are wondering if athletes should protest China's human rights abuses and recent crackdown in Tibet. Today, we're looking at the Olympics and pollution. How will Beijing's notorious pollution affect the Games? The world record-holding marathoner Haile Gebrselassie of Ethiopia says he won't run because of the air quality. And the International Olympic Committee recently agreed that air pollution could be hazardous to certain high-intensity athletes. Well, American coaches and trainers say their athletes will be present and prepared through the use of specialized scientific and highly secret methods of combating the difficult conditions. Dr. David Martin is an exercise physiologist and trainer for the U.S. Olympic track team. Dr. Martin, welcome.
Nice to be here.
Also joining us, U.S. Olympic marathoner Dina Kester, who won a bronze at the 2004 Games in Athens and is considered the top contender at the upcoming Women's Olympic Marathon Team Trials in Boston. Dina, welcome to you as well.
Thank you so much.
And Dina, you are the American record holder in the Women's Marathon. As we said, the world's men's record holder pulled out. He cited his asthma, but didn't want to endanger himself because of the pollution. Did you ever think of pulling out?
Pulling out of the Olympic Games was never an option. It's the epitome of our sport. I mean, we work year in and year out, day in, day out, to prepare for these games. And although there's other competitions in between, this is really our stage to shine. But we do have a lot of great tools that physiologists such as Dr. Martin has given us U.S. athletes to use, and it worked well in Athens in the last Olympics, and we hope it works just as well this time around.
Well, in fact, Dr. Martin, we understand that's why you can't tell us some of the things that you're doing with the athletes, because all eyes are on the U.S. Everyone wants to know how the U.S. is training.
That's right. Everyone wants to know our secrets, and we'd like to divulge our secrets after the games are finished.
But do you worry about, their health? I mean, the runner, the Ethiopian runner, Gebrselassie, who pulled out, has exercise-induced asthma. First of all, what is exercise-induced asthma?
Well, exercise-induced asthma is simply a situation where when he runs, his airways reflexly close because they're sensitive to toxins in the air. As if the lungs are saying, protect me, protect me. And so they close up. And you can imagine how traumatic it would be to run down the street and find that your airways are closing and you can't get oxygen.
Well, then we understand that in Beijing, some of the pollutants are, particles in the air. What is the pollution that they'll be facing in Beijing?
One of the biggest pollutants in terms of breathing for people like Dina is carbon monoxide. Carbon monoxide interferes with the ability of oxygen to bind to hemoglobin. And oxygen is what powers us along when we're running a race. So that comes from cars. Now, there's a good chance that Beijing will restrict automotive traffic in the weeks during the games. And these races are also on the weekend, so there's not as much traffic anyway. So that kind of pollutant is not going to be of much concern, although it's a very powerful pollutant.
And, Dina, we know the International Olympic Committee is asking athletes to wear special masks, to maybe not come to Beijing until the last second. So are there broader things that you're thinking of doing, outside of the secret stuff, to protect yourself?
our Olympic trials are coming up, so I'm hoping to get in the top three to earn my spot on the team. I hate to be premature in thinking Beijing when I still have this stepping stone of the Olympic trials coming up.
I have to jump in to say that's very humble of you. but I'm holding this month's issue of New England Runner. There's a preview of the women's team trials, which, as you said, are set for April 20th here in Boston, the day before our Boston Marathon. But the article compiles an expert panel of coaches, each of them giving their top three picks, and you come out number one from every single coach. So,
yeah, very flattering. This is an Olympic year. It's exciting. Everybody's talking about it in the news and amongst the athletes and coaches and organizing committees. But I really believe that the Chinese Olympic Committee is in the world spotlight right now, and they have a chance to make this a fabulous Olympic Games. And whether that's taking cars off the streets or shutting down industry, that they're going to do what it takes for the athletes and the people that have flown around the world to spectate this event.
I'm assuming you haven't run in Beijing yet?
No, never. But I've seen pictures, and they don't look very nice.
It's kind of smoky there. Can you tell us what it feels like for a runner when you know you're in heavier pollution?
To run in pollution, specifically being an endurance athlete, it's definitely going to be a challenge. We won't see world record times in these games for the endurance events, but I think a lot of the pain is going to be after and the recovery after. That's when the athletes are going to have the pollution taking its toll. But in saying that, we haven't had our pre-Olympic meeting with Dr. Martin and the other physiologists yet, who have taken multiple trips to Beijing and collected so much data over the past few years. But I will say, before the Athens Olympics in 2004, that we got wonderful information on how to train for heat and humidity and to stay out of the big city for as long as possible.
Well, and in Athens, with that terrible Athens heat, which knocked out the UK's Paula Radcliffe, you won the bronze. So, Doctor, something you said worked.
That's true. It pays to know the problems of the environment. In Athens, we had a big mountain to climb, and we spent a good deal of time trying to devise strategies for getting these people to perform well up long, never-ending hills in heat and humidity. That's not a normal training mode, but they rose to the fore and devised training plans to actually accommodate to this kind of stress.
The IOC is recommending these activated carbon filtration masks, and that athletes use them. They filter out 85 to 100% of major pollutants, that they use them during workouts or leisure time. Are we going to see athletes walking around Beijing with masks on?
You can wear a mask all you want walking down the street, but when you're competing, you're turning over much larger quantities of air. And so if the mask does not work during competition, you can walk down the street all you want. It has nothing to do with how well you'll race.
And, Dina, looking ahead to Beijing, as long as we have you here, who do you see that you think is going to be the big competition? And are the Chinese athletes going to be better prepared than anybody?
You can bet that the Chinese are going to be well prepared for this, just because it is their home soil and they want their stars to shine on home turf. So the Chinese will be great. Paula Radcliffe, you can't count her out, running 2:15, well ahead of any other competitor. She'll be a tough one to beat. And Mizuki Noguchi from Japan, who is the defending gold medalist.
We understand some of the Chinese team members are teenagers.
Well, we've been following this really closely. The Chinese have five top-level women now that are running in the 220s, and I think four of the five of them are teenagers. The problem with the Chinese is that they're going to be under extraordinary pressure to succeed. And so I would hate to be a Chinese teenager with that kind of pressure on me.
Well, that's Dr. David Martin. He's an exercise physiologist and trainer for the U.S. Olympic track team. We also were speaking with Dina Kaster. She won the bronze in the 2004 Olympic marathon. She'll be participating in the U.S. women's team trials in Boston on April 20th. Dina, is there anything we can do to help you prepare for Beijing? Should we start our cars when you come?
I think I'm going to stay far away from the pollution for as long as possible and treat my lungs well, since they've done well for me over the past few years.
Well, best to you. And Dr. Martin, thanks to you as well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And just a quick reminder, you can always listen to our show stream live at our website, here-now.org. You're listening to Here and Now. Hey, how'd you like to be one of the first to test the new Google TV site? You can watch all the latest TV shows online at no cost. Sound too good to be true? It is, and it's one of the most popular internet hoaxes making the rounds. John Brandon wrote about internet hoaxes for Computer World magazine. John, let's start with that Google TV. How do these hoaxes even get traction?
It's one of those phenomena of the digital age that the blogs are reporting on these things and then the people are finding them so easily. You know, it's just a matter of time before millions of people have seen it.
The Google TV hoax is put together by a young man named Mark Erickson. He's right there front and center. He makes it look sort of like an infomercial. It's on a YouTube video explaining the long process to get a chance to see Google's new site. Let's listen.
Google will soon unveil this on-demand TV service, already supported by three of the four major networks. You can call up any current TV shows or TV shows from network libraries for free. You watch them streaming, and they're embedded with ads based on keywords found by Google bots in your cache and email history.
Now, so I understand that people were desperately trying to make this work.
Yeah, I heard of one person who clicked 100 times, and I have to admit, kind of full disclosure, that I fell for this one myself. You know, you're supposed to go and click your icon in Gmail until it finally comes up. And a lot of people got hooked by that.
Well, and the fellow behind it, what does he get out of this? He doesn't make any money doing this, does he?
He is actually working for a company called Fatal Farm, which is kind of a small marketing company. I think they're in California. And they just kind of do these types of things. It's kind of viral marketing. They're not really selling anything. Mm. But in a way, if they do a really successful job, you know, maybe Hollywood is going to come knocking at the door and say, can you make us a video or two?
So it might be good for business for them. There's another video from Haiti that you point out, and it shows a spaceship zooming above somebody's handheld camera, you know, just like those shaky home movies that you see. This spaceship, and there's two of them, they look so real.
Well, and once again, this is another company that was making a viral video. The thing that's kind of ironic about this one is it's a real production company. I think it's connected with Michael Gondry, the art house filmmaker who made Eternal Sunshine for the Spotless Mind.
Uh-huh.
And he actually is going to, this is the rumor anyway, that he's going to make a movie about two kids who make a viral video about these spaceships flying across the sky. And the guy who's involved in that thought it'd be funny to release this video and see if anybody actually fell for it. And, of course, they did.
Well, one hoax that you talk about led to legal action. It involves some people in the Czech Republic who hacked into the live feed of a TV camera on a weather TV station and put video on, and they used these special effects to show in this sort of serene scene, sort of panning the bucolic countryside, suddenly, boom, a nuclear explosion. What happened to them?
The thing that was a little bit heinous about this one is that it was on a live weather channel, and all of a sudden you're sitting there watching it and you see a bomb explode. And so the rumor I've heard is that these guys are basically going to be up for some prison time. The thing that I think is kind of an issue, it kind of makes the web a little less reliable and a little less trustworthy.
Well, and you say, you know, another reason that's a problem is that something called Internet 2 might get more support. Tell us what Internet 2 is.
Internet 2 is actually it's kind of a consortium of universities and colleges that wanted to separate themselves from the public Internet, and they wanted a very reliable, very high-speed network. And so there's a lot of theorists that say the Internet, too, could one day become more of a commercial web where you have to pay a fee and, you know, it's more reliable and trustworthy because it's guaranteed somehow, maybe through the government, maybe through commercial entities like Microsoft or Google.
Which means finally supporters of regulating the Internet and sort of reining in it a bit might have a place to do that.
Right, and I think every time someone, you know, gets sued over a Wikipedia entry or, you know, Internet hoax causes people to, you know, get all worked up, it just kind of degrades it just a little bit more.
John Brandon wrote about the proliferation of Internet hoaxes for Computer World magazine. You can link to our website, here-now.org, to find out more. John, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Sure.
Okay, next, we're off to Iceland, where the cold must have frozen their taste buds. Our resident chef will sample the national delicacy, rotten shark. Back in a minute, here and now. Sometimes we check to see if you're paying attention. For instance, on the fifth anniversary of the war in Iraq, which I called The War on Terror. Judith Antonelli of Brookline, Massachusetts, was one of many who wrote, "The fifth year of the War on Terror, what were you thinking?" Well, apparently not much. It was, one, the wrong word. It's the war on terrorism. Two, of course, the wrong war. And three, it was further conflation of the war on terrorism prompted by 9/11 and the war in Iraq. A perfect trifecta of a mistake, and we apologize. We have time for a couple more of your thoughts. Paul Creedon of Quincy, Massachusetts, was disappointed in our interview with David Quammen, who's been studying the so-called contagious cancer that's wiping out Australia's Tasmanian devils, who seem to pass it by rubbing faces. Well, Paul writes, "The use of the word contagious was misleading. The cancer transmissions, as described, were all implantations of cancer cells. It's hyperbole to refer to contagion, which implies transmission through normal human contact. As a cancer as well as AIDS survivor, I was reminded of the pop science garbage that was written in the early 1980s. That led to a wholesale victimization of gay men and a very terrible isolation of people with HIV. And finally, Paula from Pennsylvania wrote after our look at the repugnance factor. It's the way consumer discomfort affects the economy. Paula writes, "You mentioned that money lending was not permitted at one time in Western Europe. Well, that's because in the Old Testament, a Jewish person was not permitted to charge interest of his fellow Jewish believer, but he was allowed to charge interest of a foreigner. I belong to the conservative plain Mennonite community. Life insurance is still prohibited in many conservative Mennonite groups because it's looked at as gambling on someone's life, and money is loaned within our brotherhoods on an interest-free basis as a kindness to our brethren and to build up the community. We are to, in honor, prefer, put first, one another, and sacrifice for one another, even as our Lord gave himself for us. I hope this is helpful." Yes, it is. Thank you. And you can send your thoughts to letters@here-now.org. When Here and Now's resident chef Kathy Gunst joins us, she usually tells us about food that is fresh, delicious. Not this time. Kathy went looking for really bad food, and her journey took her to Iceland to sample some of the world's most notorious cuisine.
Iceland sits between Greenland and Europe in the North Atlantic. So far north, there's only about 5 hours of daylight during winter. So as you might imagine, this island nation is cold and dark this time of year. Its barren landscape is covered with snow and ice. For a first-time visitor, it was a dismal greeting. I had heard that Iceland had some of the best food in the world, particularly the lamb and dairy, but it also has some of the worst, most disgusting food on the planet, including one dish so bad it's actually famous. They even have a bad food festival. When I visited Iceland recently, I knew I had to expand my culinary experience and try this really bad food. So my guide took me to a grocery in an old neighborhood in the capital, Reykjavik. At first glance, Melabudin looks like a typical grocery store. It's small, bright, soda, chips, and crackers fill the aisles. To find the bad stuff, you need some help, someone in the know, like the store's owner.
My name is Fredrik Arthur Gudmundsson.
Fredrik, a tall, thin man with thick glasses, greets me with a large smile and an equally large tray filled with samples of Iceland's notorious cuisine.
And what we're going to do now is taste some of this traditional Icelandic food.
Okay, what have we got here on the tray?
We got actually pickled ram testicles. Got some haggis, Icelandic haggis, liver pudding, and we got sheep jam that is actually made from sheep heads, and this is pork.
Okay, pork I know, but pickled ram's testicles and sheep's head jam? The food was pink and gray. It looked like coarse pate and smelled like something that might attract a very hungry cat. Fredrik also brought out a bottle of Icelandic schnapps called Brennevin and gave me my instructions.
So you taste this and you drink the Brennevin?
Exactly.
Okay. We're brave. We'll give it a try.
Sure.
Very small taste.
How does it taste?
Strong.
And sour?
Very sour. The sour I wasn't expecting. and kind of stinky.
Wow. Thank God for the schnapps. I definitely needed a shot of it to help me wash the food down. And after a few drinks, well, I was getting used to the smells. But what's the appeal of these stinky, rotten-tasting dishes? Friedrich tells me the recipes go back centuries to Viking traditions.
We're talking about her pickled or soured food. It was done in the autumn and eaten then after Christmas and more or less until spring, because this was the best way actually to keep the food fresh. So people actually had something to eat because, of course, we had no freezers.
No freezers? What's he talking about? For most of the year, the whole country is a freezer. One of the ways that Icelandic people deal with the long, cold, dark winter is to celebrate during the ancient Viking festival of rotten foods called Thorablot.
Do you think this is an acquired taste? In other words, it's something you learn to love, or?
One can say that, yes. But the funny thing is that young people, they actually, a lot of them like this. But this, of course, was first and foremost tradition with the older people that hold to the tradition. But then now it's more of a nice habit, so to speak, to eat this every year, at this part of the year.
Next in our tasting came one of the most prized foods in Iceland.
This is shark.
Shark?
Yeah.
Shark blubber?
Yeah.
And since this is Iceland, the shark is, of course, rotten. I told myself, I'm a professional. Be brave. So I closed my eyes and steeled myself for the first bite. Then I made a mistake. I took a whiff of the fish. The smell was so strong, I thought I would pass out. Then my guide, Jan Oliver Michelsen, confirmed my worst fears.
I have to tell you now how we let this rot.
Okay, tell us the whole
you know,
story.
We put it in the ground, and then we just put a sand over it. And then every day, the man who produced this, is most of the time there is an old man. Every day, he goes out and have a pee. The first pee in the morning.
Like?
The first pee in the morning should go over this.
And what does that do?
For 7 or 8 weeks. What does that do? You have the smell.
You have the smell. It's right.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. It smells like a New York City subway.
Yes, I know.
In the summer.
That's why I could not wait for this.
Jan, Friedrich, and I talked about other Icelandic foods like puffin and whale and dried cod coated in salt and left to hang out to dry for months. We drank the Brennevin and we laughed. With the taste of rotten shark lingering in my mouth, I thought back to the dinner I had the night before in one of Reykjavik's hottest new restaurants. Lamb so tender you don't need a knife to cut it. Finally, there were no more rotten foods to taste.
I thank you so much. This has just been a real education in some foods that have never touched this mouth before and may never again.
I hope you enjoyed it.
No, I did enjoy it. It was a real education, and I thank you so much. How do you say to your health in Icelandic?
You say skál.
Skál.
Yeah.
And scald you. I can't imagine what they'd think of our Twinkies. Here and Now's resident chef Kathy Gunst in Reykjavik, Iceland. Here and Now, a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.